So should I start again?
That's okay. Just go on.
Okay. Mark is the director of the Synagogue Initiative for APAC. As the director of the initiative, he's responsible for outreach to the synagogue community, specifically to our members and to the clergy, with the goal of greater participation in pro-Israel activism by all of us, by our members and clergy alike. What's especially notable about Mark is that prior to his arrival at APAC, he worked for many years for the United Synagogue of Conservative Judaism. From 98 until 2005, he served, amongst other things, as the National Director of Public Policy. He was also the Executive Director of the Seaboard Region of the United Synagogue, based in Washington. And following that, he was the Executive Director and the Youth Director of the Empire Region in upstate New York. It gives me great pleasure to introduce my friend Mark and to hear his presentation on APAC today. Mark?
So before Mark starts, I'm going to mute everybody on the call. We've just found in the past this helps without echo or background noise. And so, Mark, when you speak, you'll need to unmute yourself by pressing star 6.
Okay.
And then when we get to the Q&A, anybody who wants to speak needs to press star 6 to unmute themselves in order to speak. Okay?
Mm-hmm. It says that I'm unmuted. I hope that's the case, and I'm actually talking to people that can hear me versus just talking to myself. But Alan and Rebecca, thank you for having me and arranging this session. It's really my pleasure to be here with all of you over the phone to talk to you a little bit about APAC, but also, more importantly, talk to you a little bit about some of the issues that are going on in the region between Israel, the United States, Iran, and the Arab states. I just want to start just for all of your own purposes, but also for the recording. The information presented today is for your benefit. It's for your education. It's to help you educate your congregants on these issues. But my remarks are off the record. So let me just, since some of you, I believe, are not very familiar with APAC, and what I hope to do also just is, you know, my remarks last for about 20 minutes or so we have plenty of time for Q&A, since I think that is the most important aspect of this session. Since some of you may not be as familiar with APAC, let me give you a very quick overview of APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. We are the leading pro-Israel lobby, working to maintain a strong partnership between the United States and Israel, and that is our primary focus and our primary goal. We work with the administration to help foster that relationship and to help impact policy. We also work and primarily work with the United States Congress on these issues also, and it involves a number of different areas, heavily involved in terms of lobbying for and advocating for hundreds of pieces of legislation, some such as the annual foreign aid bill, where this year, and we'll discuss a little bit later, there's a proposal for Israel to receive $3 billion in aid, bills such as the Iran Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act, IRPSA, to help enact sanctions on the refined petroleum industry in Iran that will ultimately hurt their energy sector and therefore stall and hopefully eliminate their drive towards a nuclear weapon and a number of other areas also. We primarily do this through educating members of Congress. It may be hard to believe, but most members of Congress aren't really focused on Israel and the issues facing Israel. On any given day, a member of Congress, the only thing that they are focused on is probably what's on the front page of the newspaper. And as we know from reading any hometown newspaper, even national distributed newspapers, Israel is very rarely on the front page of the news. And when they are on the front page, it's usually not very good. But that's what politicians, members of Congress are paying attention to that day. And then also, even going back further before they're even members of Congress, candidates for Congress, there are only a handful of districts, congressional districts in the country, where Israel is any sort of significant issue in an election campaign. And most members of Congress have absolutely no knowledge whatsoever about the issues facing Israel going once they become a member of Congress. They weren't foreign policy specialists prior to running for Congress. You have members of Congress who are doctors, florists, salespeople, business owners. They haven't focused on these issues prior to running for Congress. So we educate them about these issues so they can hopefully vote on pro-Israel legislation, favorably on pro-Israel legislation. Next, we work with the public, the American Jewish community, and the pro-Israel non-Jewish community. We work with this public to lobby members of Congress, work with your congregants to lobby Congress. And we do this by working with all of you to identify pro-Israel activists and potential pro-Israel activists. We then educate them on the issues, because having a citizen lobbyist that is not educated on the issues in terms of what they're lobbying on is not a very good a citizen activist, so a citizen lobbyist. And then we train your congregants, your communities, on how to be effective pro-Israel activists so that they can educate and encourage their members of Congress to vote favorably on pro-Israel relations. The last aspect is in terms of the overview about AIPAC. I just want to share a couple of our core principles. One of our main core principles is that we are not a prescriptive organization. We do not advocate for certain Israeli policies. Israel has a very vibrant, some people would say overly vibrant, democracy, where the Israeli citizenry is able to make their opinions known to their elected government. And when they aren't happy with their elected government, they've been, you know, they have taken necessary steps to, you know, to proceed to elections to get new governments time and time again. And ultimately, those Israeli citizens, especially when it comes to matters of security, matters of life and death, they're the ones that have to live with the decisions that the Israeli government makes. So we do not feel here in America that we can prescribe certain policies to the Israeli government and the Israeli public. And that's why our focus not only is that we're not prescriptive, that our primary focus is on maintaining and enhancing that U.S.-Israel relationship, because we are convinced, and as we all know, that Israel's strength would be seriously diminished without a close U.S.-Israel relationship. And then the second very important core principle here is that everything that we do is and must be bipartisan. It must attract Democrats and Republicans. Israel cannot afford to be a Democratic issue or a Republican issue. The minute Israel becomes a Democratic issue or a Republican issue, the only loser in that game is Israel. And in addition, so one of the ways that how this philosophy works itself out in terms of from a practical standpoint is we will not advocate for, we will not propose, we will not support any legislation before Congress whatsoever, whether it's a law, a bill, a resolution, a letter, whatever it might be, that does not have bipartisan support. And to give you a specific example, there's really this isn't known far and wide. But AIPAC, we have a policy on energy. And our policy is that we believe that we need to end dependence on all oil, not just foreign oil, but all oil, that we need to end dependence on oil. One of the reasons this is not widely known is that AIPAC has not supported or gotten behind any piece of energy legislation before Congress, because there has not been one single piece of legislation, energy legislation before Congress, that helps achieve this goal. that has been able to receive, or the ability to receive, bipartisan support. And so while we have what we think is a, you know, an important policy goal of ending the dependence on oil, we have not been able to actively work on any pieces of legislation because so far no energy legislation, and for any of you who have followed over the years the energy debate in Congress and in Washington can understand anything in that realm. So since, as I mentioned, primarily what our work involved is educating members of Congress and educating the public, I want to spend the next bit of time, most of the time here, educating all of you and talking to you about some of the issues that are going on. So let me talk to you first about Iran. And that is a side because it's still, you know, just not good news. Iran is continuing on their march towards a nuclear weapon. Today they are enriching their uranium instead of to the levels of 3.5% and 5%, which is not to go into the scientific details too much, but that's the level 5% enriched uranium is the level that you need for energy purposes, to use it for energy purposes. They now started to enrich, and they say it's probably up to 20%. Now they say 20% because that's the level for medical purposes, but to understand this, it doesn't get progressively harder to enrich uranium. Once you enrich uranium to get to the nuclear levels, which is essentially, you know, about 90% or so, it doesn't get harder as you go. It's actually the first 5% that's harder. It's the first 20% that's harder. And once you get above those numbers, it's actually very easy to enrich to the higher levels. So if Iran gets to the 20% level, they've succeeded in 80% of the work needed to get to the level for a nuclear weapon. In addition, they just recently announced on the 9th of this month that they developed a new advanced third-generation centrifuge, which is the cylinder that spins the uranium. It means that they are going to be able to enrich the uranium even faster, which speeds up the timetable that they're going to, speeds up the timetable in terms of getting a nuclear weapon, but what's more important here in this whole debate is in terms of having the knowledge to get a nuclear weapon, because it's not when Iran is weaponized that's the problem. It's when they have the knowledge and the know-how and the technical ability to weaponize that's the problem. That's the red line, there, and they're actually going on that march. And Iran is constantly trying to go around existing sanctions, get harder for it, and then we also know from a couple months ago, has been trying to build additional secret nuclear sites, such as the one at Qom, that has been discovered. An interesting thing about it that was discovered at Qom is that facility was designed, and the specification of it, it's not possible to use it for energy purposes. Not only is the current plant at Natanz, not only can that completely suffice for all of Iran's energy needs, the way it was built at Qom, you couldn't even use the enriched uranium that could be done at that facility for energy needs, which means that only, logic says, was going to be used for nefarious purposes. So while they've been trying to skirt sanctions, sanctions, have been working, and there's also law in place right now that the United States can exact even more sanctions. Now, right now, the United States is actually working with the United Nations to try and get the next UN resolution. There's active discussions among the Chinese and among the Russians to get them on board. And the conversation with the Chinese right now are going back and forth. The Chinese have agreed to talk about sanctions resolutions and finding the appropriate language, which is progress, whereas previously they weren't even willing to talk at all about a new sanctions resolution in the United Nations. But that could change at any moment when it comes to China. The same thing with Russia. Right now, the big issue right now is China versus Russia as much. And they could back away from the table next, delay even more. There are certain things that the United States could do right now. They could continue to They could use their existing authority to sanction foreign investment in Iran's energy sector. In addition, there was a New York Times report from the beginning of March that the United States over the past decade has awarded $107 billion in contracts and grants to 70 companies that have violated the spirit of U.S. sanctions. Not necessarily the technical law, but the spirit of sanctions. And the federal government could stop giving out those contracts to those countries. In addition, what you're starting to see is that even just the threat of sanctions has worked. And you see it even though, as I mentioned earlier, the Iran Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act, which is currently pending before Congress, it has passed the House, it's passed the Senate. It's expected to start in conference committee tomorrow. So hopefully within the next several weeks, it'll actually get passed out of Congress. And what that focuses on is sanctioning companies that provide Iran with refined petroleum products. Because remember, while Iran it produces oil, the refinery plants, they can't refine the oil for gasoline to meet their population's needs, and they are a net importer of refined petroleum. So the sanctions would sanction companies that provide Iran with refined petroleum, that provide them with expertise or parts to fix their current refineries. And probably one of the most important provisions of this legislation is that it also could sanction insurance companies for insuring ships that bring over refined petroleum. And remember, the refined petroleum comes over in big cargo ships. No shipping company is going to bring over any product, let alone refined petroleum, without having proper insurance on that ship and those and the products within the ships. And so you have a provision that could sanction the insurance companies for insuring those ships. And so even though this legislation is not law, you're actually starting to see an impact here in terms of a number of traditional gasoline suppliers leaving the Iranian market and no longer providing refined petroleum products. And what's important just over the long term here is you can sort of see sanctions have had an impact. Just in the notion here that Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon today. They're having trouble getting the materials. And if we think about this here, the United States in 1940 started trying to build a nuclear weapon. They started the nuclear project in 1940. Before anyone else had done it, before there were computers, before there was the internet where there was the designs for building a nuclear weapon on the internet, before even that any of that occurred, it took the United States 5 years to build a nuclear weapon. Iran has been at this for over 20 years in terms of trying to do this. Now, we're successful in the fact that they don't have a nuclear weapon yet. But they're still on that march, as I mentioned. So we have a lot of work to do in that regard. The next topic that I want to talk about is sort of talk about the peace process and the U.S.-Israel relationship. Obviously, the U.S.-Israel relationship has gotten a lot of play. I've been under some strain over the last several weeks, month or so, and there's a lot of different nuances to it and a lot of fast-changing facts to all of it, and I'm happy to explore all avenues of this here during the question and answer session here, but let me talk to you a little bit about some of the issues that are going on in the peace process in the U.S.-Israel relationship. And let's start with the peace process in terms of where we are. You're all followers of the issue, so you know that the peace process right now is essentially nowhere. But one of the things that we need to do as a community and to educate our community about this is to really just lay it out in terms of what Israel has done to try and advance peace. Let's just go over, review some of the facts here. For the first time in his career, Bibi Netanyahu has endorsed and is prepared to negotiate a two-state solution. Even before that, not a widely known fact, and definitely not reported enough, but when Bibi was putting his coalition together, There was a lot of talk in terms of, you know, with Livni trying to get into the coalition and what the demands on her were for, from her on Bibi in terms of making statements about the peace process and a two-state solution. But what's not as I pointed that the members of the right wing, of the right wing parties, were putting pressure on Bibi saying that I'll only join your coalition if you come out now against a Palestinian state. And Bibi, in putting the coalition together, told those right-wing parties that, no, that he was not saying that. Now, as he came out during his Bar-Ilan speech, came out and endorsed and prepared to negotiate a two-state solution. He put an unprecedented, you know, 10-month moratorium on building in the West Bank. No prime minister has ever done this before. Israel has removed more than 350 West Bank checkpoints and roadblocks in the last couple of years. 210 of those barriers have come down in the last several months alone, and that has, along with the increased security cooperation with the Palestinian Authority between Israel and also the United States training, has really helped boost the West Bank economy, where they're growing by 7% a year, is really having a tremendous impact. And probably the most important aspect here is that Bibi's willing to sit down and talk. He's willing to sit down and talk with the Palestinians without preconditions about all the issues. And what's not talked about enough is that Mahmoud Abbas refuses to come to the table and is setting preconditions just to talk, preconditions that have never been there before. When there was construction going on in the West Bank, Abbas sat down with Olmert, sat down with Livni, sat down with Sharon. When there was construction in Jerusalem, Abbas sat down. Now he's not even willing to sit down until there's absolutely no construction going on whatsoever, just to talk. And that needs to get out there more. In addition, in terms of the role of the Arab states, not beginning to even start any sort of normalization with Israel, let alone their lack of support for the Palestinian Authority, but not to try any signs of normalization with Israel in terms of routine overflights of commercial airlines, not even the IDF, of commercial airlines from Israel, that's a real problem. And that doesn't do anything to advance the cause of peace. It definitely doesn't show anything to the Israeli public that their neighbors truly want a real peace. Now, let's talk about the U.S.-Israel relationship and what's going on right now. The first thing that we need to discuss is important here is that this is and has been a very, very pro-Israel administration. And we think just what's been happening in the last 14 months, the Obama administration has supported last year $2.775 billion in military assistance to Israel, and this year $3 billion. They've expanded defense cooperation and joint military exercises between Israel and the United States. They've been a fabulous defender of Israel at the United Nations against false charges and efforts to demonize Israel and delegitimize Israel, the Durban 2 conference, and so on. And the Obama administration has been unbelievable in making sure that the Goldstone Report could see the light of day. The Obama administration absolutely needs to be recognized for this, and there's tremendous activity going on. Now, as we all know, that we had this little dust-up the housing, the apartments in Ramat Shlomo, that was during Vice President Biden's visit to Israel. That announcement, it was a mistake. It should not have happened. And Bibi apologized for it on the spot publicly apologized four times for it, worked out appropriate language with the Vice President's staff, and on the ground the Vice President accepted the apology. Vice President comes back to the United States, and the United States, raises the level. We know about the call between the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and the Prime Minister, President Obama, condemns the construction. Really not construction because they're just construction permits, and one step in a multi-step process. And the United States really raises the level in terms of publicly disagreeing with Israel and using such stark language in terms of putting the relationship in jeopardy. There's a couple of aspects here in terms of thinking about this here. And some of it has to do with policy and language, and some of it is in terms of the relationship as a whole. The first answer that we have to sort of talk about here is that there's a lot of throwing out of the word settlement. We have to start working harder, not only amongst ourselves, but also as the community at large and our elected officials, that we don't refer to Jerusalem as a settlement. Jerusalem is not a settlement. Yes, there might be some confusion that, when we say 1,600, units at Ramat Shlomo, that someone could think that it's 1,600 single-family homes, mansions, and so on, when it's really, just 1,600 apartment units. That's understandable, and that can happen. But we need to make sure that Jerusalem's not being referred to as a settlement. And that's some of the language that's coming out, definitely in the press, and also within the administration as a whole also. More importantly, going to the process here, Israel and the United States are going to have policy disagreements. They have policy disagreements now. They've had policy disagreements in previous administrations. There is nothing wrong whatsoever with policy disagreements between the U.S. and Israel. It's a question of how we work those disagreements out. And that friends and close friends and close allies, such as the United States, work out those disagreements in private. Now, you work out those disagreements in private for two reasons. One, that's how friends treat each other, number one. And number two, when you do it publicly, and when you show that type of distance, public distance, between the United States and Israel, it actually makes it harder to achieve the U.S. policy goals of peace in the Middle East. Because you have two factors to this here. You have one, you have the Israeli public knows that they're going to have to make hard concessions, and the Israeli government knows that they're going to have to make hard concessions for peace with their Palestinian and Arab neighbors. And poll after poll over time has shown that the Israeli public is willing to make those hard sacrifices for true peace, but that they have to know that the U.S. has got their back. And by creating this public distance over policy versus making it private, it makes it harder for the Israeli public, let alone the American Jewish community, to know that the administration has Israel's back. The second aspect is in terms of what it does to the Palestinians, the Palestinian negotiating position, because no Palestinian leader is going to be able to take a position that is less than what the U.S. administration position is. That makes it even harder to get to negotiations. It's even harder to reach the compromises that Israel and the Palestinians have to reach. And that's why, out of all of this, to a certain extent, some of it's about the policy debate. But the bigger issue this is that we have got to work to make sure that we get the U.S. administration and the Israeli government working closely together in private as friends so they can work out these disagreements together. So lastly, let me tell you a couple things in terms of what we could use from you here. And I have three things here. One is our annual policy conference, and Alan can tell you all about it, and some of you, on the call, have been there. But it is the annual premier event where 6,000 pro-Israel activists come to Washington to share and show their love of Israel and the U.S.-Israel relationship. This year, there were about 16 cantors at the policy conference. I would love to see that number at least double for next year. We want you there. We want you there for two reasons. One, it sends an important message, obviously, that you know that you're making your voice heard. You're coming to hear the speakers. You're coming to hear the elected officials. Those elected officials who come to us, Secretary of State, the Vice President, the President, coming to us, and also to lobby your elected officials. But it also shows to your congregants that this is an important issue and that you, too, have to come to Washington to be a pro-Israel activist and let our elected government know that we care about these issues and are paying attention, which leads to the second aspect. Please get your congregants involved. Get your congregants, educate your congregants about these issues. Get your congregants involved in pro-Israel political activism. We all love Israel. And we all have different connections to Israel. We can't just love Israel. We can't just become educated about Israel. We have to actually act on that. And one of the ways to do that is that through pro-Israel political activism. And the last aspect of this is lobby your members of Congress. Now, if you go to our website, APAC.org/take action, they'll have our latest lobbying agenda. But the aspect to this here is that you need to constantly be letting our elected officials know about what's going on here. I mentioned foreign aid, the military aid, $3 billion in foreign aid. That's going to be coming up. It comes up every year during the budget cycle. It's vital that Israel gets military aid. It's absolutely essential it needs it for their qualitative military edge. In today's economy, in the deficit that the U.S. budget is facing, the Obama administration needs to be credited that they are, as part of a long-term agreement, but it has to be approved every single year and proposed every single year, increasing military aid from $2.775 billion last year to $3 billion this coming year, a $225 million increase. In a year where we have soaring federal deficits, where the federal budget is being proposed as a whole to either being to actually get cuts and break and no growth on the domestic side, to have an increase and aid to Israel is a very, very difficult vote for members of Congress. Even though 75% of the aid is spent in the United States, it's a very difficult vote, and we need to let our members of Congress know that this is important, that we care about it. With that, I'm going to stop, since we have until about 1 o'clock. That gives us about 20 minutes or so for whatever questions you want about APAC, the organization, about the issues I raised, whatever's on your mind. I am happy to do my best to answer that. I turn it back to Alan or to Rebecca.
So once again, press star six to unmute, and then after you finish your question, star six to remute yourself. And please introduce yourself by name before you ask your question.
Hello.
Yes, please ask away.
Hi, this is Barry Kanarek. How are you doing?
Doing well, thank you.
Wonderful presentation. Thank you. So let me ask you, I was very interested in your remarks regarding APAC being a bipartisan coalition, and it's a very good point. How do I answer congregants, my Republican congregants, who are attacking the Democrats, basically, attacking the Obama administration. Because I want to feel, as a Democrat, and I'll just put my politics on the table, as a Democrat, I want to be part of this as well. And I am, as a pro-Israel Democrat, I think we need to get this away from the partisan American politics back to a unified support Israel position.
It's an excellent question. I can't reiterate enough in terms of if this becomes a partisan issue, there's significant trouble ahead for U.S. support for Israel. It would have, and I don't think we're there, you know, anytime soon, but it would be devastating. I think when it comes in terms of your fellow friends in terms of what the Obama administration here, and there's a couple things here, all of which is true. The Obama administration and President Obama himself is pro-Israel. They, as I mentioned earlier in my remarks, the annual foreign aid, the speaking out hard against Goldstone, the defense cooperation. We can go on and on and on of where the U.S. and the Obama administration, President Obama, has shown pro-Israel support. One of the items that I did not mention that has not received a lot of press, and it really isn't receiving a lot of press because the Obama administration didn't make press about this, and this is important here. Over the last several weeks, Israel has been bombing Gaza. And you've read, you know, you might have read, you know, small snippets in a paper here or there because of the increased rocket and mortar fire that's been coming from Gaza over the last several months. They've been bombing Gaza. The Obama administration has said nothing, and this is a good thing, they've said nothing about Israel bombing Gaza. They haven't condemned it. They haven't said show restraint. Saying nothing in this situation is a very, very good thing. It allows Israel to continue to do what they need to do in Gaza. In every single area where it comes to Israel's security, the Obama administration and President Obama himself really absolutely, from what we have seen, absolutely and know that they are committed to a secure Jewish state of Israel. The disagreement comes in some of these peace process issues. But the fact of the matter is, and this is what I tell you, friends, there have been peace process disagreements with the previous administrations, previous Republican administrations. It's happened. That's okay. The area that we want to focus on, if we have some concern in terms of that, people want to express some concern with the Obama administration, what you want to do is you want to express in terms of how those issues are being handled, how they're talking to a friend, and so on. But that's what you have to lay out to your Republican congregants. Lay out all the positive things that the Obama administration has done for Israel, because there is a lot, and they should be commended for it. I hope that answers your question.
It does. I have a second question, but I don't want to be a hog.
I'm not the moderator.
Go ahead.
It's okay to go ahead? Okay. On an entirely different subject. What is AIPAC's position on J Street?
AIPAC's position on J Street is just like our position on any other prescriptive organization. J Street is a prescriptive organization, just like ZOA is a prescriptive organization. Fundamentally, we don't believe that is the right philosophy. Like I said during my remarks here, we don't have to live. By living here in America, we don't have to live with the hard decisions the Israeli government have to make about the peace process. We don't serve in the IDF right now. Some people may have or previously, or some people may, and we'll be doing that in the future, but I don't have to send my children into the armed forces. And we have to respect that. And that's why we're not a prescriptive organization. And that's the difference. But there's nothing in terms of isolating from J Street. Again, it's just like APN or ZOA or J Street. This is not a new phenomenon of a prescriptive Jewish organization. But we have a fundamental philosophical disagreement in that regard.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
I'm happy to take other questions.
This is Avi Alpert from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Go ahead, Avi.
Thank you so much for your brilliant and informative presentation. I was at the AIPAC policy conference. It was my first time. I've been a big supporter of AIPAC for many years, though. And it was really a wonderful thing to be there. And I wanted to encourage my colleagues in the Cantor's Assembly to to come next time. And I've seen some, I think part of the reason for this actual session that we're in is the ambivalence that we've seen with some of my colleagues who are really upset with AIPAC. And it's upsetting to me to know that. What, I mean, you've already said a lot to kind of clear the record in terms of what AIPAC is and what it isn't. Specifically to Cantors, why is it important in our role as synagogue leaders, why is it important that we personally are more involved and that we embrace AIPAC?
Great question. First, the check is in the mail for calling it a brilliant presentation. I'd say, you know, a couple reasons here. I'm not going to pontificate a lecture about the role of the cantor in a synagogue, but I will give you my personal opinion. It's just me speaking. But one of the roles that I believe you should, and I believe you do have, that you have the ability to impact Jewish lives. You have the ability to impact how your congregants lead their Jewish lives. And one aspect of being a Jewish life is the attachment to Israel. And if you have the attachment to Israel, and if you care about Israel, what is it that we are going to do about that? And again, this is one avenue. Listen, for some people, by the way, people who get involved in AIPAC and pro-Israel activism, it's a self-selecting group. Some people, they love Israel, and the way that they're going to support Israel is they're going to organize the Israeli Film Festival, because that's their thing, and that's what they love. And they can stand politics or lobby their member of Congress because they have absolutely no interest whatsoever. But for others, the way that they are going to show, or should, we believe many more people should be doing this, should be showing their love for Israel and doing something about their love for Israel, because just loving Israel isn't enough. It's great that we love Israel, but what are we going to do about it? Is pro-Israel activism, lobbying member of Congress. I mean, I can't stress enough, you know, we talk about the U.S.'s relationship with the peace process, but $3 billion a year in military aid, that without that over the years, without that continuing, Israel's in trouble. That doesn't happen automatically. I mean, and if you think about this, I talked about earlier in terms of members of Congress, in terms of how they thought about Israel and the professions they came from, just look at the turnover. In the last, I don't have it exactly in front of me, so this is going to be a rough guess, but in the last 6 years, about 40% of Congress is new. 6 years, 40% of the people, 40% of the 535 people who decide $3 billion in aid to Israel are brand new to ever even having to think about this issue. And we have an obligation. The Jewish community has an obligation, and your Congress have an obligation to educate members of Congress about this. And Cantors getting involved in AIPAC, in coming to policy conference and doing this work, you're showing your congregants, in addition to encouraging your congregants to do this, in addition to recruiting congregants to do this, you actually doing it shows your congregants that it's important to you personally. You're putting your time and your feet where your mouth is. And that's why it's important to come to policy conference. That's why it's important for you to come to the local AIPAC events, to do all this stuff. Because otherwise, it's just more words to congregants coming from the clergy. That's me speaking as a congregant, not as clergy, because I'm not clergy. But that's why you need to get more involved, and Cantors need to get involved. I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you very much. I have another question, but I want to leave it open in case there's somebody else that wants to jump in.
Okay, go ahead.
I mean, what you gave, the presentation that you gave was very parve and politically correct, obviously. When are we going to be able to comment on, I mean, to even go further? I mean, the so-called moderate Arab leaders are so not moderate. I mean, and they're the most moderate that we have. I mean, you know, Abbas, who has, I believe, a doctorate in Holocaust denial, basically, from the former Soviet Union. He is a moderate Arab. When are we going to be able to call a spade and just say, look, why does America try to be so even-handed at all? I mean, why is there even a question? How can we educate our representatives to see how much evil there is in our enemies and also even our so-called friendly, you know, even Jordan and Egypt? I don't know how to articulate any further. I'm just frustrated.
Don't worry about articulation. Just state the fact. State the fact. Literally, you know, I mean, it's not known. You know, any common sense person who wants peace, who believes that there should be peace, is going to say, okay, let's talk about it. You know, let's figure out what the issues are. Let's figure out how to compromise. So just letting your members of Congress, letting them know that, you know, Abbas is not even willing to come to the table. Just state out the facts.
Can't we just say that it's true? I mean, the truth of the matter is there is no desire on the part of any of the Arab leaders or any of the Arab people basically living in the region for Jews to live in that region at all. I mean, Gaza is completely free of Jews, free of living Jews and free of dead Jews and free of, you know, anything Jewish. You know, on their side, it has to be 100% Jewish free because all land needs to become Islamic. I mean, let's face it. And on our end, we have to be, you know, fair, and we have to let, you know, it has to be, we're called apartheid, even though we're the furthest thing from apartheid in the world, you know. When can somebody speak up about that and really lay into Western people who are, their eyes are just spinning and they're just like in la-la land?
I think that you had to look at it from a couple of ways. Of course, you can speak up and talk about that. I didn't even begin to start talking about the issue with, you know, how do you have peace when there's essentially two Palestinian territories right now, when you have, you know, Hamas in Gaza. You know, there's the issue of, you know, Salam Fayyad, who really, you know, is trying to build up the state institutions so that they're prepared for when there is a state. But, you know, there's concern that, you know, there's no political process behind that, and he has no political support. You look from the American administration also standpoint, the U.S. government, and again, this goes back to the Bush administration also, but, you know, obviously they shunned Arafat, but even with Abbas towards the end, you know, there's no alternatives right now. The only other alternative right now is a guy who's sitting in Israeli jail for five life sentences for murder. So it's a question of, you know, the aspect here is what needs to be talked about is that, and this is, we didn't spend a lot of time on this, talking about the role of the Arab states. Because if the Arab states would step forward more in terms of not only starting to have some normalization with Israel, but also in terms of supporting the Palestinian Authority, you're going to be able to see the Palestinian Authority leadership being able to start making more decisions and accept some of these compromises. But listen, you should absolutely be talking about it. I mean, the noise is not getting through, okay? Because all this noise is, for the newspapers, it's not sexy. What's sexy? The U.S. and Israel fighting is sexy. Settlements are sexy. Jerusalem is sexy. You know, the Arab states not allowing, you know, commercial overflights is not sexy. The Arab states never paying their pledges to the Palestinian Authority is not sexy. So it doesn't get into the paper. So therefore, it doesn't get the elected officials' attention. But we should absolutely be talking to and educating, you know, the community and your members of Congress about these issues. More questions, please. I have plenty of time, but I don't know what the exact rules are in terms of ending this conference. I leave that up to the moderators, but I have plenty of time.
We can take one more question.
Hi, this is Neil Schwartz calling. I have a question about the possibility of a backlash on the American Jewish community for the $3 billion aid. Is that something that has been at all put on the table in APEC internal discussions about possibly winning a battle but losing the larger war of popular support for Israel?
In terms of that you think it's going to raise anti-Semitism, or that it's just going to get people politically mad at the American Jewish community that we're spending $3 billion when we're in this crazy economy deficit situation? I guess I just need a little bit more clarification to the question in terms of what you're concerned about so that I can answer it, which I'm very happy to answer it. All right, I'll just guess.
That was the question.
Okay. Of course, we are concerned about what does it look like politically? What is going to be the reaction among the populace? What is going to be the reaction among members of Congress? That's who we care about, but members of Congress react to the populace. $2-3 billion in aid to Israel, a $225 million increase. And things are getting decreased all around. So there's the reality first, and then the second is what are we going to do about that reality? The reality is we have no choice but to advocate for this money. Without Israel receiving that annual military aid, the $3 billion, and Israel already spending a greater percentage of their GDP on their military than I believe it's any modern country, maybe any country. I'd have to look that up very quickly, but a greater percentage of their GDP on defense, it would be devastating to Israel's qualitative military advantage, and it would be devastating to Israel's economy, because how do you compensate then for that the loss of military aid without that aid? So that's the reality. So what do we do about that is we educate members of Congress. We educate members of Congress that 75% of all aid to all military aid to Israel is spent in the United States, creating jobs here in the United States. We educate members of Congress on the notion of that this allows for Israel to develop military technologies that are used by American troops abroad, saving the lives of American troops. We educate that it allows Israel to have these, I'm drawing a blank on the exact terminology right now, but it's essentially pre-positioning. Because of this, the United States is able to pre-position certain munitions and weapons in Israel for their use at certain times and so on. So there's a variety of benefits. This aid isn't just a giveaway to Israel. There are tangible benefits to the United States, not even talking from a dollar standpoint, from an American lives standpoint, they're not even talking about the strategic alliance that this creates, and all foreign aid creates. And we have to educate our community, and we have to educate members of Congress about this issue, and because we simply have no choice. Any closing remarks, or am I done, or what should we do?
I think it's time to wrap up. I just want to mention that it's because of Alan that we had the privilege of hearing from Mark today. Alan has been very involved with APAC, and he really brought Mark to us. So, Alan, I'd like to thank you on behalf of all of us.
Pleasure. All mine.
And, Mark, thank you so much. Thanks for your time and the information, and I think it was really interesting.
It is my pleasure. If anyone has any follow-up questions, anyone wants more information, I'm not even going to give you my personal address, not because I don't want you to get my personal address, but I'm going to make it easier for you to remember. Synagogue@APAC.org. Just remember synagogue and then APAC.org. Email us at that email address. We're happy to help you get involved, get more information, whatever you need. Synagogue@APAC.org.
That's great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody who's been on the call. Bye.
Bye-bye.